Welcome to A-Team Group's podcast on institutionalizing crypto technology, brought to you from a panel session at our Trading Tech Summit in London on February the 27th. The podcast covers the development of different crypto asset types, barriers to trading in crypto markets, including a lack of regulation, and the role of blockchain in crypto clearing. The panel was moderated by Simon Barnby, Chief Marketing Officer at Archax Exchange, and joined by Stuart Calvey, Business Development Manager at the Gibraltar Blockchain Exchange, David Nickel, Digital Assets at R3, Sebastian Higgs, Director of Business Development at Vault Digital Custodian, and Gaspard Couturier, ERP Director at BSO Network Solutions.
Good afternoon, everybody. So yeah, we're ending today with a trip into the crypto wild west. So hold on to your horses and here we go. Now before we actually introduce anyone though, or talk about what we're going to talk about further, I think we're going to put up a question for the audience, which you can use your Slido app to vote on. And we're going to ask a similar question at the end, actually. So we'd like you to vote on, or give your opinion on crypto assets, whether it's something that you're looking at, whether you dabble, whether you're thinking about it, or whether you're a complete skeptic. So if you could please get your mobiles out and vote, that would be great. And whilst you're doing that, I'll ask the panel to introduce themselves, starting with Stuart.
Sure, the mass exodus speaks volumes, right? Only the hardcore left. I'm Stuart Calvey. I work for the Gibraltar Blockchain Exchange, a subsidiary of the GSX Group. We've got a rather unconventional stance in this space, in that we're regulated, licensed, and insured as an exchange.
Hi, my name is David Nickel, and I run our digital assets program at R3. R3 is a technology company, and we build one product called Corda. Corda is a DLT, or distributed ledger technology platform, and it allows participants and application developers to build or run institutional-grade and regulation-friendly applications.
I'm Sebastian Higgs, the Director of Business Development at Vault. So we're a digital asset custodian for the insured from Aon as well. And we basically provide security to our clients around their private keys, and we can support any assets. It comes down really to a metric of internal risk assessment around different coins and tokens. Prior to that, I was working at Goldman Sachs in London for a few years and started to get interested from a traditional role in the digital asset space, and then kept going down the rabbit hole and eventually joined over professionally about a year or so ago.
Hi, my name is Gaspard Couturier. I am ERP Director at BSO. We are an infrastructure and network provider. And before that, I was a product manager at BSO as well, and I was focusing mainly on crypto-related projects.
Great. Thank you all. So so we end up with just over half of you are complete skeptics, so we'll see what we can do about that. Before we start, though, I want to kind of put a bit of context, I guess, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. And so just to clarify, you know, we're talking about crypto assets. What do we mean? Well, they generally fall into three buckets, generally speaking, anyway. And that is the cryptocurrencies, which are things like Bitcoin, which are tied into a particular blockchain implementation, so Bitcoin, Ether for Ethereum, and cryptocurrencies like that, which are kind of the things that maybe have a bit of a tainted reputation because of money laundering and what they have been used for. There's a set of assets called, generally referred to as utility tokens, and these came to prominence in 2017, and this was where firms used ICO, initial coin offerings, to raise money, raise capital for themselves, and issue a token which had some kind of utility value for the product or service that they were launching. And again, somewhat tainted, you know, last year, this is, there were some fraudulent ICO schemes, and so a slightly tainted reputation, and the fact that they were treated as unregulated made them difficult for institutions to look at. And the final category, security tokens or digital securities, this is where you're taking some kind of real-world asset, could be equity, debt, some physical asset, gold, property, and tokenizing it, creating a digital representation of it on the blockchain. These are viewed as being regulated because they look like existing securities, and the company I work for, Archax, we're building a regulated security token exchange in London. So that's kind of probably the area that's of most interest to institutions currently, although, you know, as regulatory clarity moves forward, you know, maybe other elements like cryptocurrencies will rise to the fore in the institutional world too. But anyway, so to kick things off, we want to have a look at the idea of this panel is to sort of explore the technological implications of institutions getting involved in crypto. And we'll kick off by maybe looking at how trading cryptos is different to other asset classes. You know, what problems do they present in terms of the technology? And maybe, Gaspard, you could kick off with that.
Sure. Well, from our side, the main difference between trading cryptocurrencies and trading traditional assets is that trading cryptocurrencies happens over the internet, where trading major traditional finance, traditional assets happens with direct private lines and private infrastructure within collocated data centers. So in terms of infrastructure, we see a very, very big difference of trading those two.
And Sebastian, what about you? What do you think of the different types of venue in particular?
So the... Well, it depends how you define venue in this space as well. So that can be anything from a centralized exchange to trading with a piece of code. So that aside, there are a number of differences as well around, again, being quite a nascent industry and marketplace. The liquidity is very fragmented. When I first came in here, I was looking for API connections for OTC desks. There was nothing really of that sort. It was pretty much moving on to digital open outcry with WhatsApp messaging. We've now moved away from that, so we do actually have APIs in the space. So in that respect, we are catching up with the traditional world. But as alluded to before as well, everything being online, there is a heightened risk in operating in this space.
And Stuart, as an exchange operator, you know, what in this space, how do you see the difference? And I know you have an illustrious career of trading in traditional financial markets too, but you know,
it wasn't illustrious, it was a career. So I spent over three decades as an equity trader, trading cash equities. So I came into this space 6 months ago with a fresh set of eyes and went down the rabbit hole. And the look and feel of the trading looks very similar, but the back end plumbing, as we've kind of touched upon, is so different and so far behind the kind of things that we've heard being spoken about today in terms of latency. It's not comparable in any way. As you say, APIs and web sockets, it's like going back in time. So the look and feel in many ways is quite familiar, but the actual technology behind it is quite archaic.
And David, what about you? I mean, you come from a blockchain provider or a kind of a institutional blockchain provider, really. What's your kind of take on the technology side of things, infrastructure side of things?
Yeah, thanks, Simon. So the existing market, or the market that most people have read about in the news, or the ones that are the market that's gotten the most attention over the last couple of years, has been very young. It's been underregulated, and the assets themselves, the digital assets, have been very difficult to understand what they are and to value them. So from a market dynamics perspective, from a market understanding perspective, there's still a lot of work to be done, a lot of kind of sorting out of the wheat from the chaff. On the infrastructure side, the tools and the capabilities and the connectivity, the rest of the panel has already spoken about it, but I think the ability to transact directly peer-to-peer is very interesting, and that's not fully understood yet, and the ability to directly custody assets. I'm surprised you didn't go there. But it provides both a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities. So I think that's the main difference. And a lot of the things that are challenging and difficult to understand right now may be opportunities if they're executed on in the right way, in a regulation-friendly and kind of robust way.
I mean, we'll come back to regulation. We'll come back to custody in a little bit, but maybe looking at the regulation side, I mean, what is your view of the current status of regulation and how it's moving, how it's changing, some of the issues that an institution might face and some of the remedies that are appearing? And, Sebastian, maybe you could kick off for that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it obviously being very complex, trying to fit the ideas of being able to self-custody and disintermediating financial markets and so forth. So a lot of the old principles do ring true as well, carrying over the ideas of investor protection, consumer protection, managing conflicts of interest. However, whether you start to impose mandates around you need to have a third-party custodian, I guess that's always up for debate as an example. Although it's, again, an area being very new and the variety of skills and expertise required across many, many different disciplines. So... for example, touching on custody a little bit around the regulation there, whilst the FCA is still kind of going ahead with a consultation paper seeking inputs from the market participants, to understand a bit more around how they should proceed in this space with the different varieties of digital asset we touched on, the security tokens, the more exchange tokens such as Bitcoin and Ether, Litecoin and so forth, and also back to whether actually on-chain issuance or whether it's a digital representation of something that is not native to a blockchain. These are all quite different matters. Again, it makes sense that the regulators are moving in a very cautious way. However, for ourselves as a industry participant, you know, we have to adopt a internal risk framework as well. Coming from a banking background, we have to take a view around compliance and legal as to whether we actually hold these assets on behalf of our clients, whether the structure of a certain coin is e-money, whether it's a security algorithm. It all does get quite complex. We have to draw upon many areas of, as we call it, an internal risk assessment framework. However, the regulators are kind of catching up with that as well now, trying to impose their own views on the market.
What about the whole, obviously with blockchain, or some blockchains, you have this ability to implement smart contracts and obviously build into these smart contracts elements of regulation. I mean, that might be something interesting to talk about. Is David maybe something you could pick up on?
Yeah, so from a smart contract perspective, that's, I think, a tool, right? I think from a regulation perspective, everyone's looking for certainty, and I think that those jurisdictions, those exchanges that can offer certainty to trading parties first will be the early success stories. And I think that what we're seeing, at least, is that the rich are getting richer. The first movers are really building on that capability and getting a lot of progress, a lot of success very, very early on. Simply because there's not a lot of certainty elsewhere. On the smart contract piece, I think it's very interesting that now at the asset level, not at the market level, not at the trading party level, but at the actual asset level, you're able to code in capabilities. That is, the asset's able to initiate communication, it's able to react to communication, and in that way, the rest of the life cycle outside of the actual trading event becomes very interesting. The asset's able to manage itself, to update based on corporate actions, to respond to buyers or sellers based on criteria set out by the current owner of the asset. So I think that it's pretty early days on what you're able to do with a smart contract or a smart asset that is traded and supported and managed on a platform that also supports the regulatory certainty that an exchange provides.
Can I ask a quick question? So is the coding of that straight from the lawyer's parameters that he sets with the particular instrument?
Yeah. So the question was, is the coding of a digital asset or a smart contract directly from the language that a lawyer would use to issue a security? And the answer is yes. There are lots of tools being built at that level to translate legal language directly into a digital asset. And in fact, it's making lawyers' jobs not redundant, but easier to do, and easier for them to bring in more clients, bring in more business, because they're able to use repositories of language they've used in the past. They're able to build digital assets and issue digital assets that look and feel like securities that we know today.
Thank you.
And if I may, just on regulation, as I mentioned, I came from an equity background, so I was involved in MiFID in its first iteration, and then before I left, I was involved, obviously, with MiFID II. And as I prefaced, the exchange that I work for, we're quite unconventional in that we want to be regulated. We are regulated. We are licensed. And I think for those of you who were part of the ICO utility token mania or familiar with it, you see what happens when people are left to self-regulate. And there were total scams, and we're talking billions and billions of dollars being scammed, really. So we're talking, and again, I don't know how sophisticated the audience is in terms of utility tokens and security tokens. The buzzword now, security tokens, and that will be regulated. It will be under FCA, SFA, SEC, sorry. And I welcome that, because you need a velocity change in what we've, in crypto assets. And that, no wonder people are sceptical, because what happened was quite a lot of bad practices, and regulation, as long as it doesn't stifle innovation, will be good.
And of course, regulation is at different stages in different jurisdictions.
Yeah, jurisdiction arbitrage, right?
Yeah, and you come from a jurisdiction where there is some clear clarity around crypto regulation. Others are, you know, in different
stages.
We've put
our flag in the sand as a business, and we're going to live or die by that.
Yeah.
But the background of the exchange and the people who work there, we come from the traditional investment banking background. We understand the power of regulation. We know it's a good thing.
And Gaspard, I mean, you come from a technology infrastructure provider. What, do you have an angle on regulation? What's your kind of view for looking at it from that side?
Well, I agree with the panel here that regulation is more than welcome. And what we see on the infrastructure side is mainly the players that played the regulation card early. That would be, for instance, choosing to go into a co-located data center, choosing to go into cross-connects and direct line with their clients, choosing to use HSMs to verify or store the private keys, all that type of costly but definitely regulatory driven movement definitely brings some value. And we see on our side, for instance, institutional investors and traditional finance being very interested and in asking for connections to those exchanges or to this basically landscape. So more to come. The security token will definitely be the right move towards regulation and brings more regulation into that sphere, and the entire ecosystem is moving towards professional infrastructure and professional regulation.
And maybe with some sort of clarity coming in regulation, you know, what institutions will need is some kind of market access layer that provides, you know, the ability to access these different markets or emerging markets as they become regulated. You know, what's, you know, maybe interested to get views on that, the technology that's required or what would be expected. And you know, David, maybe you could kick off on that.
Yeah, sure. So I think that this is a very interesting market. Digital assets are very interesting, a very interesting asset class to invest in, to start trading in. But the opportunity and the, I mean, the massive opportunity in digital assets is only realized when you're able to move assets between exchanges, between parties that that want to trade them. I think the big opportunity there is that if you have an infrastructure that can represent a similar asset in a similar way, so that we're all calling an equity, a bond, a gold token, then you're able to make that asset more useful in different markets. I think we saw that with a lot of financial engineering over the last 20 years. That concept isn't new. I think what's new is that you're able to see through that engineering. You're able to represent the if-then scenarios. You're able to see what actually makes up this security or this asset with more clarity. And I think that's a good thing for markets overall.
And Stuart, anything to add on that?
Yeah, sure. One of the big narratives in this space since I've been observing it is, when is the institutional money coming? When's this big wall of money kind of come into the system? And the current infrastructure just doesn't support that at all. And I don't think in utility token space, the ICOs, the ICO exchanges and the crypto exchanges, I don't think there's going to be this interoperable layer that's going to be built. It's going to come through security tokens, where it's going to be regulated, where people like the BlackRocks or the Fidelities have a comfort level to go and have assets in custody. Because at the moment, with the crypto exchanges you see, and you see wallet hacks and things like that, it's just not robust enough. So the progression of the STO space is where the interoperability will come, because it will be regulated, there will be framework, there will be comfort for institutions to come into.
And what about the kind of connectivity that's needed? I mean, Gaspard, maybe something for you, you know, the ability to connect to these emerging markets that are institutional grade.
Yeah. So basically, when it comes to connectivity, most of the exchange or most of the cryptocurrency business is happening over the internet on mainly AWS. And it's something that, for instance, here we chose to have partnership with AWS to bring direct connectivity. So then what we're trying to do is bridge the gap between AWS or the public cloud environment of cryptocurrencies and bringing it in a safely manner towards the private infrastructure and private network of institutional investors within that safe and regulatory-driven environment and connectivity, and trying to get those partners to be able to talk on the same level of security, especially.
What role do you think the universities could have in this area you've been talking about? For instance, I go to Imperial College and I'm part of their science group, and they talk about this. They've got departments, they're investing money. But what do you think how could they possibly help?
The universities?
Yes, universities. For instance, Imperial College has got a big science maths department, and they're very interested. They're doing research in this area, but they don't feature on your horizon, do they?
No.
That's the answer, okay.
I mean, we have University College London as a partner in our entity, and two of their professors sit on our board. So we're, you know, and they do a lot of work in the crypto world, and they have a lot of graduates studying that space. So we kind of work quite closely with that university in particular.
They'd like to be involved, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and they have UCL have a great record of creating businesses and, you know, floating them off into the world. So,
Thank you.
I think one area as well, I just add to that, particularly with universities, is, you know, recognizing things such as cryptography and security infrastructures, they're kind of, you know, changing over time, responding to latest threats and to the new abilities. So with the advent of things like quantum computing, there's a very big space where quantum proofing, the cryptography side of thing, and keys is a big interest, and ourselves, we have a number of research-focused individuals looking at this aspect as well, getting ready for the next threats on the horizon.
I'm going to stick with you, Sebastian, actually, because we'll move on to custody. I mean, there is a custody issue when it comes to digital assets. Obviously, you know, stolen keys and hacks on exchanges have featured highly in the press for in a negative way for cryptocurrencies, but you know, you come from a firm that's trying to address that, so maybe you could explain some of those custodian issues and what is being done about it.
Yeah, so when you come into this space and you buy Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency, you're sort of faced with a variety of custodial flavors at various points along a very vast risk spectrum. So for example, if you're trading on a centralized exchange, it's generally the case that you don't actually own that Bitcoin because you don't own the private key. It's actually owned by the exchange itself. What you're really doing is a kind of a debit and credit in an internal SQL database. You can actually move those away from the exchange onto an online wallet. Again, you're kind of opening yourself, however, to online attacks. We've also seen examples of both of those exchanges and online wallets being hacked in the past, also subject to a variety of very sophisticated phishing attempts. You can go another step further and use things such as hardware wallets, which again, there's a lot of onus on you to manage your own private key, and it's down to you to provide that level of security. However, again, we've seen examples of supply chain attacks. There are videos on YouTube of individuals hacking these devices and playing snake on them and various other bits and pieces. And then on the most extreme side, you have the cold storage, which again, that's kind of the approach we've taken. We deal with housing private keys in ex-nuclear bunkers, so we have military-grade physical and cyber protection. As I mentioned, these are all fully insured. Our team come from a variety of investment banking backgrounds, but also dealing with government information security. So, you know, this is adopting frameworks in security which already exist, but around a new product, in this case, the private key. So it really is down to the individual and their appetite for risk and how much they want to take that on themselves or how much they want to outsource so they can sleep at night knowing the private keys and their assets are ultimately safe.
And anyone else sort of comment on the custody side?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. There isn't a robust custody solution yet. Everyone's trying to play catch up because as this asset class exploded, the easiest thing, the path of least resistance was for people to start exchanges and MTFs, and all the infrastructure and plumbing behind that are all trying to play catch up now. And obviously, as I said earlier, that's why you had wallet hacks. And you continue to have those because the procedures in place are just not sufficient. As an exchange, you know, I'm not here to hawk our workforce so much, but I was part of some discussions with underwriters, insurance underwriters, trying to get insurance for our security protocols. And quite frankly, they were just saying it's laughable the people they have come to them exchanges wanting to be insured but have no security protocols. So custody is absolutely needed for the space to mature. But as I've said, infrastructure is trying to play catch up as best as it can.
David, anything to add, isn't it?
I would say custody in general is a huge opportunity. With this ability to directly custody assets, it's very interesting for a lot of investors at first, because they see that they can shorten that distance between themselves and the assets that they hold and that they then have to manage. But it comes with a lot of this back-end headache that exactly right, still catching up. So we actually recently convened a group of about 50 institutions from the buy side, FMIs, custodians, and banks. And everyone's very eager to figure out how they can change the services that are currently provided in the market, especially custodianship. And it's just about figuring out, like, understanding the assets, understanding the market, understanding how the assets are meant to be used, and then navigating the jurisdictional headaches as well.
Why don't you give that problem to the universities?
We absolutely are as well. And you mentioned Imperial College before. They're doing a lot of work in cold storage as well. So I think they're coming up with a lot of very interesting solutions.
Okay, before we got some interesting questions coming in, before we move to those, just want to cover kind of blockchain maybe in a bit more detail. I mean, blockchain is the kind of, you know, the panacea, the solution for every problem in the world, it seems, at the minute. But certainly one thing that it would appear to be able to do is provide real-time instantaneous settlement in the world of financial markets, which is quite an interesting concept. Given that post-trade is such an inefficient business in current traditional financial markets. But David, maybe you would want to kick off on this. What about blockchain? Is it in terms of clearing and settlement, and how does it fit in the future financial markets world?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of settlement for blockchain transactions, I used to tell a joke. I think it's still relevant, but that it's like teenage sex.
Thank you so much.
It's like teenage sex in that everyone's talking about it. Very few people are actually doing it. And those who are doing it are not doing it particularly well.
Yes.
it went back to that the nature of digital assets, the nature of flows and transactions on a blockchain platform, where you're able to program in conditions under which you will call something settled or which you will call something cleared. That's something that's very it's defined by the rules of markets and the operational structure of markets today. The fact that you can code that into a contract or code that into a program that you're writing to trade these assets makes it easier. I wouldn't call it a panacea. I wouldn't call it for the cure. I wouldn't call it the cure for the common cold. But I think it will change the nature of markets quite definitively.
Sebastian, anything to add on blockchain?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned a little bit earlier as well the sort of peer-to-peer nature of blockchain, and as kind of a settlement framework, it's almost the perfect DVP, the reverse payments infrastructure, which, you look at the traditional world, speak to DTCC or any other depository to understand how much security fails or delayed collateral settlements and so forth cost the industry on an annual basis. And for example, if we're moving towards native issuance on-chain, again, the peer-to-peer nature means that we can do away with a lot of those problems. And we do have a lot of that going on with various geographies around the world, such as over in Asia. Singapore is doing a lot of exploration around government security issuance on-chain, Germany as well, with their exchanges are kind of investigating a similar remit. However, I guess it gets complicated when you're doing hybrids of the two, whether you're doing, for example, a stable coin or something backed by a real-world asset, and you're having to meld the two settlement infrastructures together. They are very different, and again, it's complicated enough. Trying to put the two together is very much a square peg, round hole, and it's going to take a lot of time to figure out the intersection of those two.
And of course, blockchains need to be hosted somewhere, and they need to be connected to. Gaspard, anything from your side on the what blockchain can bring and how it needs to be used?
I think blockchain brings, especially in the traditional finance, a very efficient way of settling, trading, and tracing exchange of property, exchange of assets, and the immutability of it, the fact that it's public or not, is something that is brand new, and that is only at the beginning of a real revolution for traditional finance in this way. Now, the only thing that differs from traditional finance is that the efficiency, the cost, and the speed has been reduced. However, what blockchain doesn't do is responsibility. Who is responsible for that trade? If something was wrong, what happens? I think it's a fear where blockchain and an external game will have to happen and define through regulation to really kind of cover the whole spectrum of traditional exchange and traditional exchange of value and asset between institutions.
Yeah. If I could just jump in there, I think that people things go wrong, and when things go wrong, as they often do in technology and programs that you write, people want someone to sue. And so I think that people will look for exchanges that are based on platforms that give you that legal recourse and that finality.
Stuart, I mean, yeah, you come from a blockchain exchange, so...
Yeah, I'm going to slightly digress because something just popped into my head, and talking about the whole technology and the potential of it, and I feel a little bit like it's like looking at a one-year-old child trying to think what that child's going to be and look like on their wedding day. And for me, we're on the cusp of something very, very interesting here, and trying to predict what it's going to be like in 10 or 15 years is a real tough thing. But I just have the feeling that this is... the technology and the ethos and the peer-to-peer drive behind it, I think this could be the solution for lots of problems, and I'm very optimistic for it.
Okay. Well, let's pick off some of the questions that have come up since we've been talking, and there's one there at the top about, you know, why have the larger traditional exchange groups not jumped in, except for maybe using futures, but, you know, anyone want to pick that one up?
Regulation. It's the Wild West. And people don't want to be retrospectively penalised for that. And as we've said, there's no infrastructure around all these exchanges. The plumbing's just not there. There's no custody solution. There's no clearing solutions. So at the moment, the infrastructure's not there. It's on everybody's radar. We know that. Everybody behind closed doors is doing work. And obviously, now some of them are becoming public with that. But the infrastructure's not in place. And obviously, there's a fear factor for regulation about exactly how the regulators are going to respond to all of this.
Yeah, I would jump in that I think in the past, the nature of crypto assets has not been something that's very attractive to traditional FMIs, traditional exchange groups. I think that now when you apply that technology, those capabilities to security tokens or assets that look and feel like things that people, that institutions actually want to invest in, they are jumping in, and I can tell you they're definitely jumping in. We're working with a very large European exchange who has answered a lot of the questions here, and that will be public in the next couple of weeks. I think I also heard a podcast recently about NASDAQ and their the technology that they're selling. They're kind of working their way into different digital asset markets, digital asset exchanges. I think we'll see more and more of that. It's not that they're creating something from scratch, but applying technology that exchange groups use and build today to serve these markets.
And it's interesting today that the London Stock Exchange have announced that they've invested in Nevura, who are a tokenization infrastructure provider. So that's an interesting move by an existing exchange. So there's a question at the back, I think.
Thanks, Simon. I just wanted to sort of make a comment on that. We've just completed some research around, you know, what it would take to get the financial institutions, not necessarily the exchanges, but the large brokers, to get involved. We've had some sort of on again, off again, publicly at least, interest. We've seen Goldman, you know, the Morgan Stanleys and JP Morgan's dabble, perhaps. What we found from the research is that regulation is a key aspect, lack of regulation, but very specifically the lack of KYC processes. This seems to be a real bugbear. I just wondered what the panel thought about KYC and how it might be resolved, particularly as one starts to jump, you know, these sort of like on-ramps, if you like, from fiat currency into cryptocurrency. Once you get past the on-ramp, you know, the KYC checks seem to sort of fade away, and that seems to be a bit of a barrier for people.
Yes, I think on the KYC and AML, I think maybe a little while ago that was definitely the case, although I think the last 12 months or so, definitely a lot more robust. Again, just, you know, you have to look last year at the sort of talent coming to this space, whether it's from Wall Street or whether it's from the technology side and the developers, all bringing various know-how and experience in other walks of life. A lot of it from financial institutions, bringing that risk management framework. You have MLROs in this space as well who try to comply as much as though they were a regulated entity and act by the same rules of that road. But again, you know, this kind of comes back to the point as well around everyone is doing it as much as they can with the KYC AML. You also need to have other outsiders who are also pushing that forward as well to comply with the next directive and to include within that framework the cryptocurrency and digital asset space as well.
In terms of KYC and AML as a business, we actually get quite a lot of pushback because our policies are too strict. And it's a very unequal playing field that we have with our competitors because our processes and procedures, highly regulated. We're an EU-regulated entity, so we have to be extremely strict. So processes are in place, but they do impede us at the moment, which is a bit unfair because we're doing the right thing.
I'd say it's getting more and more KYC. I mean, nowadays you wouldn't probably get into an exchange without a KYC, especially if you're dealing with any fiat trade. So KYC is really there. And now, especially with security tokens, you wouldn't even be able to trade or buy any security token if you're not an accredited investor in the US. So if you haven't gone through the KYC process and being accredited. So it was true, especially for the ICO boom, where there was basically no KYC and only at the later end because they were actually facing huge penalties. But nowadays, it's really really focusing on the KYC process. This is something very serious.
We're rapidly running out of time. Maybe we could do the audience question. So we'll put up a similar question to the one we had at the start, just to see whether anyone's changed their mind. So it's, you know, are you looking to extend? Do you think crypto asset trading, continue to dabble? Has all your skepticism been blown away, or do you remain skeptical? And whilst you're pressing buttons on that, on the Slido app, the panel, maybe we could just go back. One of the other questions that came up was, how do we think that... will the market remain niche, or will it grow, and how long will it take? So maybe looking to the future a little bit. I'll kick off with you, Sebastian.
Yeah, so I mean, I think we can definitely take the view it's here to stay. It's just a matter of what form is it going to take, as sort of alluded to previously. It's hard to say 10 years from now how the space is going to look, although, again, we've spoken about the various